Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My colleague and co-host Sam Wong is off today. It's summertime, and that means baseball. For those of us sitting through the summer heat, this is the time that you can watch your favorite team and enjoy our national pastime. Baseball is the ultimate escape for many people, a place we can sit, enjoy, watch a game, and perhaps keep our minds off all the turmoil in Washington. Yet the truth is that sports and politics are never that far apart. This year, we've watched a lot of this with President Trump's ongoing battles with the NFL and players who have decided to kneel for social justice. And there's a long history of politics and sports mixing and intermixing throughout the history of our country. Today we have with us Kurt Smith to discuss the issue of presidents in baseball. In addition to being a former presidential speechwriter, Smith is the author of 17 books, including a classic history of baseball broadcasting called Voices of the Game. He has many other books and called Pulling Up a Chair, Mercy, and many, many more. He's the host of the Voices of the Game series at the Smithsonian Institution and the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. He's been a columnist in many media outlets, including Newsweek and the New York Times, and has also hosted shows on the radio. But today we're here to discuss his new book, which is a terrific book called The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House, which is out recently from the University of Nebraska Press. Kurt, welcome to our show.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much. It's a treat to be with you.
So how did you decide to write a book about this subject of presidents and our national pastime?
Well, I think the idea had been a twinkling, actually, since my childhood. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York, and we were time zones away, it seemed, actually hundreds of miles from the nearest major league franchise. So to follow baseball, as any good American child did in the mid to late 20th century, I did so through radio and television. And these were the voices of the game. And they made the game seem more riveting even than it was. And so I fell in love with baseball. And I was transfixed as well by that other great American institution, the presidency. And so it was that I became enamored of baseball and the presidency. These were the two and are the two great American institutions. They were originated here. They were born here. They are ours. And they have been with us now for as long as the history of the Republic. In fact, baseball was with us even before the Republic. George Washington, for example, played a British derivative of baseball called rounders at that terrible, frigid winter of 1777-78 at Valley Forge. And I write about that. I write then after the birth of the nation about Lincoln playing town ball outside of the White House at the White Lot, what we know as the Ellipse today, and then bringing baseball inside. So baseball's roots run deep, run very deep, run far more deep than any other American sport.
And just so our listeners know, when does professional baseball start, as we know it, with a professional association and teams? When does that take form?
Well, the first professional baseball team really began in 1869, the Cincinnati Red Stockings, which later became, of course, the Cincinnati Reds, and the two major leagues, the National League in 1876, the American League in 1901. And ever since then, this has been the division that's become as familiar to any American as almost any extended member of the family.
And which presidents have been the biggest fans of the sport?
Well, that's an arbitrary question, but a good question. A demanding, perhaps an arbitrary, but a good response. I would say probably, as far as knowing the game, being familiar with the game's history and statistics, Richard Nixon, who was uncoordinated, not a good athlete at all, but knew the game as would a savant, almost an endearing Walter Mitty love of the game. As far as being a great athlete, a fine baseball player, as well as having an enduring love of the game, my former boss, for whom I had the great privilege to write speeches for from 1989 through 93, and that would be a George Herbert Walker Bush, who picked up a baseball bat, swung it at age five, and said in a very precise way that encapsulated his love of the game, he said, "Baseball has everything." That was at age five. He recently turned 94 years old. He's still watching and loving the game. He played the game. He coached the game at Yale as captain of the team. He was such a good defensive first baseman that a coach said to me, and a scout for the minor leagues, that had there been the position of designated fielder, that George Herbert Walker Bush could have made the major league. So I would have said, and do say, that Richard Nixon and George Herbert Walker Bush, probably the greatest baseball fans, although you can also make a good case for Franklin Roosevelt, who adorns the cover of the Presidents in the Pastime. All that he did, as I make clear in this book, was during World War II, he saved baseball. He preserved it after the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor.
One of the things that was interesting that you discuss in talking about President Woodrow Wilson is a little bit about how the sport, like for many people, you know, provided some relief from the burdens of the job and the difficulties and challenges that the inhabitant of the Oval Office faces. Could you tell us a little bit about Wilson and his relationship with baseball?
Well, he loved the game, and he had played the game. As an eight-year-old, he had had a picture of a diagram of the field's dimensions of the game that he had drawn on his geometry notebook. He had then become a center fielder for Davidson College. And as a president, he had set a record by attending four baseball games in his first April as president in 1913. But after he had his strokes, which disabled him and made him a semi-invalid in the last several years of his administration, he had become incapacitated, and his wife, in effect, had become the president. And so Wilson, for him, baseball became a refuge, an oasis. And he would, on any day that the Senators were playing, would take the limousine from the White House to Griffith Stadium, the home of the Senators. And the limousine would take him to the Senators' home bullpen. And the top would come down, and Secret Service agents would stand on each side of the limousine and protect him, Wilson, from foul balls that would come his way. And then Wilson would go back to the White House and go with a personal aide to a room called the dugout. And they would discuss that day's game and the prior day's other games in the major leagues. And for Wilson, this literally was the refuge, if you would, that kept him alive. It was all that he had to look forward to. His dreams for peace were gone. His dreams for preserving democracy and for extending it to all points of the earth were gone. Only baseball lasted. Only baseball was there. And I think as far as loving the game, probably Wilson was right there with any other president that ever occupied the Oval Office.
So in addition to their hometown teams, the Washington Senators have always, now the Nationals, have always had a special relationship to presidents because of their location and because they become the hometown, in essence, for the president of the United States. How has that relationship unfolded with that particular team?
Well, it's been ubiquitous, and it's been endemic. It's been an enormous relic and part of the national pastime really since 1910, when William Howard Taft inaugurated the right of the president throwing out the first ball to commence the Major League Baseball season. On April 10th of 1910, Taft threw out the first pitch. And Wilson then followed him when he succeeded him in 1913. And since then, every president of the United States, with the singular exception of Jimmy Carter, and so far Donald Trump as well, has thrown out the first pitch. Carter didn't do it because he was a workaholic. Trump hasn't done it for reasons that he has yet to explain. But the relationship has been really what I call a twinning of the heart. And presidents, I think, have found relaxation, refuge. They have found celebrity value that they have found to be something that they look forward to. And athletes, players themselves have found a certain cachet in becoming associated with the president of the United States. So on both sides, there has been something to be gained. And presidents, with the exception of Taft's predecessor, Theodore Roosevelt, who hated the game but was afraid to say so because baseball was so popular, with that exception, all presidents with varying degrees of acceptance and liking and even love have, in fact, embraced the game of baseball.
And that opening pitch has now become such an iconic moment, you know, that it's notable when the two presidents didn't do it. How did Taft decide to do that? Was he invited? Was this his idea? What was the story behind that first pitch?
Well, he was invited to by his top aide, who thought that it would be good for his public relations profile. And his profile was a rather large one. He weighed 300 pounds. For anyone who remembers the 1960s Jackie Gleason television show and his iconic portrait character, Reginald Van Gleason III, when you think Reggie Van Gleason, think William Howard Taft. They were almost identical. And it was a correct assessment, because when Taft went out to the stadium for the first time at Griffith Stadium, the crowd exploded in applause. They couldn't get enough of their president. So it's been an undiluted success for the president of the United States to go out and throw out the first pitch. And with rare exception thereafter, presidents have absolutely and eagerly welcomed the chance to go out and show themselves as a populist, a man of the people. And this is why it's been so surprising to me, as a former presidential speechwriter, that Donald Trump has not welcomed the chance to throw out a first pitch in either 2017 or rather 2018 to boot. It's been a missed opportunity for him and a missed opportunity for Washington, which has come back with abandon and with great enthusiasm since welcoming the Senators back as a major league franchise in 2015. I say Senators, it's Nationals, but those two names have been used interchangeably since Washington first acquired the franchise way back in 1901.
And then one of the interesting parts of the book has to do with some of the relationships between presidents and different players. And you have a good story about Warren Harding, who has a drink with a very famous player in the Oval Office at an unexpected time.
I do indeed. Warren Harding was, shall we say, a tad of a hypocrite. On the one hand, he was elected in 1920 on a landslide. But he was elected as a champion of prohibition, which, of course, banned the use or sale of any kind of alcohol. Publicly, he continued that support of prohibition. But he also loved baseball, and he was a great exponent, even more, of Babe Ruth, the great star of the New York Yankees, who came to Washington a number of times each year, the Yankees playing the Senators 11 times in Washington annually. And whenever Ruth came to Washington, Harding had the Babe to the Oval Office to discuss baseball and also to have more than a couple belts of very, very distinguished bourbon, which Harding would have shipped in by kegs of bourbon being brought up to the very entrance to the White House. So what a dichotomy we have. On the one hand, Harding is publicly supporting prohibition. On the other, he is mocking prohibition by having every kind of booze you can imagine being brought into the White House so that he and Babe can have a blast of a time building it up and discussing ball, which they did with abandon any number of times each year. Thankfully for him, the nation knew nothing of this while Harding was president.
I had written a little bit once about Richard Nixon and football, and one of the things that was just interesting was to hear how much he used football in his discussions of politics and policy. It was a way for him to understand what to do and what was unfolding. Did you find with some presidents that their love of baseball actually informed their strategy in politics, or sometimes the language they use during you know, key political moments?
I find the parallels between them a way for them to understand their favorite game and their favorite vocation. Politics and baseball have a great deal in common. They're both complex. They both involve a strategy. They both demand that you use your full faculties, intellectual, physical, often moral, spiritual. I think they are very clear cut. You know, after an election or a campaign, who has lost and why. I think that they are enormously competitive. And I think the stakes are very high, certainly for the presidency. That's rather obvious. But I think in many ways, some of the politicians, the presidents, would-be presidents, are enormous fans as well. So to them, they have an outsized estimate, if you would, of how high the baseball stakes are as well. With Nixon, he was such an enormous baseball fan that he truly looked at baseball, I think, as a mirror of the country. And baseball was, for him, a way to relate to the average person in a way that made him seem more endearing. And a Walter Mitty type of adoration of baseball did make him seem more approachable. He was rather austere, rather formal, rather difficult for him to know for the average person. Baseball bridged that gap in communication. And was one reason, I believe, among many, that he was able to win his 49-state landslide in 1972. That was one of the more real tenets of Nixon's veneer. Some were less real. Baseball was very real.
And when did presidents start? We read a lot about this now, and we hear a lot about the World Series champions coming to visit the president. Is that an old tradition?
No, it's not old at all. It began with the former great broadcaster turned movie actor turned president, Ronald Reagan. The Gipper began his career, of course, doing recreated games, which meant that you took games that you never saw, took Morse code, and then reinvented them, the recreation. Where Ronald Reagan showed his mental agility and his fluid tongue at a very early age. Then he became a movie star and played the actor Grover Cleveland Alexander. Then he became president, and in 1983, I believe it was, began the practice of inviting the World Series champion to the White House. And he loved it. And the World Series title team loved it. And he used that, right, incidentally, during the dark days in the 1980s, that time when Washington did not have a team. And he kept baseball in the capital area alive during that dark ages. And in a sense, had the capital team embraced the Baltimore Orioles as an adopted team. Not quite the home team, but at least in the capital area, kept interest in the pastime alive. Until in 2005, a real team did come to Washington when the Montreal Expos moved. So I give the Gipper a lot of credit for that. He also had other events that he staged, and then rather aptly, the final event, really, in many ways, of his 8 years, he goes to Wrigley Field, where his broadcast career really began with the recreation of games that he had done for WHO Des Moines, and he does play-by-play for an inning and a half with that great Falstaffian character, the Chicago Cubs play-by-playman, Harry Carey. And just as Reagan is about ready to leave office, he tells Carey, "I'm leaving office. I'm going to be needing a new job in about 2 months, so I thought I'd have some audition training here." And that was truly the Gipper. But he was the one that began this right, and it was far less controversial than it is today.
And when does it become controversial? There are other instances before. We've seen this a little bit with sports now, where some players on a team protest and don't want to meet with the president. Do we have any incidents like that since Reagan started this tradition?
No, not in baseball. There have been perhaps one or two players that have decided not to visit the Oval Office, which is fine. That's their constitutional right. They can choose not to attend. But no, there's been no full-scale decision or pretense to boycott or blacklist. And I think it's fine. It's far better, it seems to me, for politics not to become involved in baseball. There are a zillion ways for Americans to protest this, that, or the other thing when it comes to social activism. You don't need to do so on a baseball diamond. Baseball, thank goodness, is immune, it seems to me, the actual playing of a game, or certainly the honoring of a World Series trophy. I don't think you need to intrude upon that and sully in the eyes of millions of American baseball fans what should be a nonpartisan and non-political event.
And then war has often, you discussed this a little bit, but it's often during times of war, it's either impacted, you know, the ability of baseball to function professionally, or it's become a source of protest, obviously, in the 1960s and 70s. Tell us a little bit about presidents' war in baseball and some of the moments when this relationship has had an important role in the history.
Presidents in war, correct?
Yes.
Well, World War One was a case of baseball being indecisive in terms of how it would approach the coming war. Remember, America was indecisive itself regarding whether the U.S. would become involved, and if so, at what level and at what date. Woodrow Wilson himself was indecisive regarding whether America would become involved. It didn't at any rate until the verdict was somewhat decided, and we didn't become involved until 1918 at maximum strength. So baseball suffered a reduction in the length of its schedule, really, in only that 1 year of 1918, in which the World Series was played in September, not October. The real possible interruption could have been severe, could have been fatal, in fact. That was World War II. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Baseball, not atypically, was clueless in terms of how to react. On January 14, 1942, baseball commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who hated Franklin Roosevelt — Kennesaw Mountain Landis was conservative, FDR was liberal — wrote Roosevelt a letter, and it said, Mr. President, we don't know what to do. In effect, should we continue in 1942? Should we fold up shop? Please tell us what to do. And the very next day, Roosevelt answered. He answered in a press conference. He said and read out loud the contents of his letter in a presidential press conference. This is how important baseball was to the tenor of America in 1942. And what Roosevelt said was this: I don't softly and gently suggest that you play baseball in 1942. I insist that you do. Baseball is that important to the tenor and impact on the home front, and the morale here at home, and more important, to the morale of troops abroad. And he was right. He knew his game and he knew his country, because later it was shown that nothing mattered more to troops abroad except for letters from home ones here at home, than box scores of baseball games and game accounts of games that troops received from newspapers abroad. So Roosevelt helped win the war through baseball. And in effect, he saved baseball, because it was entirely possible that baseball would have folded its shop, and more than likely would have never returned after the war. That's not me talking. It's baseball officials. I catalog that very chronologically in this book, The Presidents of the Pastime. That's why I suggest that, in fact, Franklin Roosevelt be inducted posthumously into the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York. There are 317 plaques of players, owners, and other executives in the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown. None include this phrase: saved baseball. Franklin Roosevelt saved baseball.
And another iconic moment in this relationship is after 9/11, when President Bush throws out the pitch at Yankee Stadium. before Game 3 of the World Series. What happened when he did that?
That was an extraordinary moment, and I write about it at length in The Presidents in the Past Time. And difficult for me because it was such an heroic moment. I only hope that my prose is somewhat equal to the drama of the event. This was New York City, October 30, 2001. Bush goes to George W. Bush, goes to Yankee Stadium for Game 3. No president, amazingly, has ever thrown out a first pitch before a World Series game in the big ballpark in the Bronx, despite the dozens of World Series that the Yankees have been a part of. So he goes into what Bush writes later is the magnificent undercarriage of the big ballpark in the Bronx. And he and Derek Jeter, the great shortstop of the Yankees, are warming up by throwing the ball back and forth. Jeter says to Bush, "I think that you should throw the ball out from the mound, not in front of the mound." And Bush says, "Well, Derek, if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me." So Bush goes to the mound and throws from 60 feet, 6 inches, to the plate, which as anyone who has ever tried to master this art knows seems like 60 miles, 6 feet. Bush winds up and he throws the ball. And keep in mind that this is only 7 weeks since 9/11. And here we are in New York, the epicenter of this extraordinary day of terrorism in American history, when nearly 3,000 people have been killed. The raw emotion in New York convulses through the stadium, and indeed through anyone watching on television at home. What this crowd wants is simple justice, some sort of recompense for the terrorism inflicted upon the land, which throws. And he could not have thrown a more perfect strike or more precisely split the plate had he walked the 60 feet, 6 inches and lovingly placed this ball in the mitt of the Yankees catcher. The roar of the crowd, the venom, this primal scream, this atavistic, if you would, roar that arose from this crowd in the Bronx must have reached Jersey City, 15 to 20 miles away. It was an extraordinary and historic moment. George W. Bush was never more a hero than he was that night, nor ever would be again. This, to me, ranks second only to Franklin Roosevelt among all the historic moments that involve a president of the United States and the national game.
Well, on that incredible story, we're going to have to wrap up our show. Once again, our guest has been Kurt Smith, the author of The Presidents in the Past Time, which is out with the University of Nebraska Press. Kurt, thank you for joining our show.
Doctor, my pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.